Welcome to the February 23rd service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. The presentation today is given by guest speaker Chris Alderman, and the title is Recovery and Resilience. Chris is introduced by Worship Associate Victoria Taylor.
So as I mentioned earlier, I met Chris through my work with Addicts in Recovery. And one of the things that I've learned about working with addicts in recovery is people who don't work with addicts in recovery have no idea of the power of these people, of their strength, of their intelligence, of their courage. The other thing that I've noticed working with addicts in recovery is how useful the 12-step program is. And one of those things I think actually everyone should work through, except perhaps not the first step. So I'm now going to share those with you because everyone knows about the 12 steps. Do people know the 12 steps? These are from Alcoholics Anonymous. They are obviously modified for other 12-step programs. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to others, the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now I'd like to turn the podium over to Chris Alderman.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I'm very grateful to be asked to speak here today. It's not common that I get asked to speak in a church setting, but I am very grateful for the opportunity. So my story consists of a lot of addiction. Obviously, there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of resilience, a lot of pain and suffering, and so I'm just going to share that with you. And you know, when I share my story, it's very emotional for some, and in some environments, it's very triggering for some people. So I hope that doesn't happen today. So I'll start from the beginning. I was born in Roanoke to a heroin addict and a mother with very serious mental illness. When I was 2.5 years old, I got adopted by a school teacher and a postal worker from Floyd County, and that's where I was raised, was in Floyd. Prior to being adopted, I experienced some severe trauma as an infant. My father used to put cigarette butts out on me. He used to kick me when I was laying in the floor. He would walk by and stomp on me. And so that was my first traumatic event that happened in my life. And, of course, I don't remember any of that. I was told that when I met my biological mother several years ago. And also I have some brothers and sisters I met that confirmed that story. So that's how my life started. And, you know, I was kind of when I look back at it, when I first heard that that those events happened, I was I had the mindset that I was kind of doomed from the start. Like there was no hope for me from the very beginning. And so I got adopted, was raised in Floyd, and I had a decent childhood up until fourth grade. Prior to that, I mean, my whole life I've always had what I needed. I had clothes and shelter and food. I never done without anything. I was raised in a good home. My parents did the best they could. They were very good people. Something happened to me in around fourth grade. One of the first things that happened was my grandfather passed away, and the reason that was traumatic for me is because he promised me that the next day he would be at my baseball game. He'd never been seen me play baseball, and he told me he would be there, and he passed away that night. He had a brain aneurysm and died. That affected me in a very negative way. The second thing that happened, and this is where it gets kind of intense for some people, is that I got sexually molested by one of my friend's fathers. In the shower. I went to spend the night at their house. He came in the shower. And when that happened, I didn't tell anyone about that. I told no one. I actually didn't tell anybody for almost over 25 years. I didn't talk about that event. When that happened, I had a huge distrust for people. I didn't really like anyone very much. And I became very isolated. I became very withdrawn. During that time, I also started engaging in other behaviors. I started breaking into people's houses. And I started just destroying their houses. I stole my dad's car, went to Myrtle Beach. I did a lot of things that a kid at that age, a normal kid at that age, probably wouldn't be doing. At age 13, I smoked marijuana for the first time and absolutely fell in love with it. And the thing about addiction is when I chose to smoke marijuana, it was a choice. I chose to do that. And when I did that, I found a whole new set of friends. I'd been bullied up to that point a lot. I got bullied in high school. I was also a bully. But I found a new set of friends, and I actually, the euphoria of it, absolutely loved it because it took away all the emotional pain and suffering that I was feeling. I absolutely loved it. So I started hanging out with a crowd of people, and oh, there's a Hershey bar up here. And I started hanging out with a group of people that were doing other things. And the first time I overdosed, I was 14. I overdosed on caffeine pills. I took two boxes of caffeine pills trying to be the cool kid. And I got very, very sick from that. All through my high school career, people expected me to do certain things. Like I'm 6'6". Most people expect me to play basketball. I do not care about basketball. I've never cared about basketball. I'm not interested in it, but that's people's natural assumption. I still get that today. People ask me if I play basketball. I'm like, no, I didn't. So the expectation, and also with my mother being a school teacher, people expected me to do really well in school. I did not. I barely passed high school. And a lot of that had to do with the activities that I was participating in. I was using drugs, and I was partying, and I was doing what we do in Floyd. You know, back when I was in school in Floyd, you know, you had a couple options. You had drugs, Jesus, or sports. And the only thing I was really interested in was the drugs. I didn't grow up in a very spiritual home. We went to church some on Sundays, but I was not interested in that. So at age 17, all through my high school from age 13 to 17, I was just partying and drinking and smoking some pot, taking some pills, nothing too major, just caffeine pills. And back then we had something called mini thins, which was pseudoephedrine. So I took some of those. At age 17, I left home. I went to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to a children's home. Had a girlfriend down there, and that's the main reason I went. I convinced my parents to let me move out at 17. Broke their heart. Devastated my mother. When I got down there, I was at the children's home for 2 weeks and got kicked out for smoking marijuana. And what they told me was is that you're close enough to 18. If you find a couch to sleep on, then you're gone. And so the girlfriend's parents said, you're not coming and living with us. My parents said, we're not coming to get you. And so I was sleeping on couches. And sometimes I would sleep outside. Sometimes I would eat out of trash dumpsters. So I was basically homeless in Winston-Salem, North Carolina for about 3 months, approximately 3 months. During that time, my second sexual trauma happened. I was sleeping in a building. And at that time, I was using more drugs. I'd found some hallucinogens down there and was using those. started using some opiates, painkillers. And when I was sleeping in one of these abandoned buildings I was in down in downtown Winston-Salem, I was attacked by three men. They raped me, they beat me, and they stripped me, and they left me for dead. And that's something that it's hard to come back from. You know, how do you come back from that? And again, it's something I didn't tell anyone. And when that happened, my dislike for people was still there, but when that happened, my dislike for people intensified quite a bit. I despised people. I had no trust in people. Basically, I hated them. I hated everyone. And so I found my way back to Floyd and moved in with a cousin's house, with a cousin at her house, and she was married to an abusive alcoholic. And so when moved in there, he would get drunk, and he would beat me, and he would beat the kids, and he would beat her. And it was a horrible, horrible living situation. I lived there for some time, and I was sitting one night watching TV, and I was pretty high. And this commercial came on and said, "Be all you can be, join the United States Army." I was like, "That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to join the Army. I'm going to get away from these drugs. I'm going to make Mom and Dad proud, and I'm going to do something with my life." And so that's what I did. I went into the Army, and I'd love to tell you that's where it all ended and everything's great since then, but it's not. Because here's the thing about us as addicts is that you can put me anywhere. You can put me in the middle of a desert somewhere, and I'm going to find the drugs. All right, and that's what I did in the military. I started using cocaine when I was in the Army and drinking more heavily. So I signed up for the Army Reserves for 7 years. I got actually kicked out of the Army Reserves for the cocaine use. So I don't really consider myself a vet. I went to basic training. I went to school, and that was it. I didn't do anything else for the military. So that was another opportunity that I kind of destroyed because of drugs. So after that, I met the mother of my children. I have three kids. Two of them were by her. I have two daughters by her, one at her ages 20 and 16. And then I have an 11-year-old son as well from a different marriage. So I met my daughter's mother, and she didn't know I used drugs, and I didn't know she used drugs. But when we found out that we both used drugs, it was on. And we started using, we started smoking crack cocaine. We smoked crack together. And that's a drug that will totally take every single thing that you have and throw it all away. And so we smoke crack every single day. And that's an expensive habit. We're talking like anywhere from $100 up to $1,000 a day. And so, you know, we have two kids, and she had another child. So we had three kids there smoking crack every day. And, you know, when we talk about addiction, we talk about abuse and neglect. And part of my story is I absolutely abused and neglected my children when I was using. There's no doubt about it. And so, you know, I can remember having a pocket full of drugs and my kids not having any food. I can remember my kids, I'd wake up from a blackout and they'd be eating raw spaghetti noodles. And that's something that I have to live with. And it's something I've worked through because who I am when I'm using is not who I am when I'm clean. And I know that today. So we did that for a couple years. We got on a meth binge for a couple years. I used meth pretty heavily. And in that time, from ages 13 to 26, when I turned 19, around 19 or 20, I used drugs every single day from age 19 to 26. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't use something. And there isn't many drugs that I haven't done, mainly the club drugs, the ecstasy and stuff like that I've never touched. But in the end, I was using heroin, cocaine, and Xanax every single day. And I was using to the point where I would black out, pass out. I've overdosed four times. The worst overdose I had was when I was using meth. I've been up for 13 days. And, you know, 13 days and no sleep, no shower, no food. I was a little bit delusional, just a little bit. And during that, on that 13th day, I took a handful of Xanaxes and my heart stopped. And so when I think about all these things during my using career, I wonder sometimes, you know, why am I the fortunate one? Why am I one of the fortunate ones that got to live through all that? You know, what is my purpose? Why am I the lucky one? And so age 26, I was working as a maintenance man in Blacksburg. At an apartment complex. One thing you don't ever want to do is give an addict keys to every single apartment in an apartment complex, because I robbed people daily. And eventually I robbed the apartment manager's mother, and she found out about it, called the police, and I got arrested for grand larceny. When I got arrested, I was very intoxicated. I was sitting talking to the police officer, and of course I denied it. I was like, I didn't steal anything. I don't know what they're talking about, until my daughter's mother called and said, yeah, I know what he took, and I know where it is, and she described it very well. So I did get arrested. I got put on probation. I got reduced down to petty larceny, which is a misdemeanor, and got put on probation. And I went to see my probation officer, and he said, it sounds like you got a problem with marijuana, because I didn't tell him about the other drugs. I didn't tell him I was using heroin every day. I just told him I was smoking a little bit of weed to help with my anxiety and the stuff that we tell people. And basically he said, you've got 30 days to give me a clean urine sample or you're going to jail for 2 years. I said, okay, I can do that, no problem. That lasted for 3 days. 3 days I went without using, and I was back smoking crack again. And I was sitting on my couch one night, and I was on a crack binge, been smoking crack for about 3 days. And I had a 25 automatic pistol, and I pulled it out, and I put it to my chin, and I was done. What I was thinking, my thought pattern was, is I'm a failure as a father. I'm a failure as a son. I can't keep a job. I can't keep the electricity on. I was one of those people that they'd turn my electricity off, and I'd run back outside and plug the thing back in. That's the life I was living, still with three kids in the home. And so I put the 25 automatic to my chin, and then my daughter, who's 20 now, walked out and saw that. She saw me with the gun to my head. And at that moment, I had what we call a moment of clarity. And what that moment of clarity told me was, is there's got to be more to life than this. You can't be living like this. And so the next day I got up and I called some treatment centers, and most of them wanted insurance or a lot of money, neither what I had. And eventually I called New Life Recovery Center in Radford, told them almost everything I was doing. And they told me to be there Monday by 9 o'clock. This was on a Saturday. And of course I had to celebrate, we got to celebrate going to rehab. So I got pretty high for the rest of that weekend. I actually smoked a joint on the way to rehab. Because my intention was, is I'm going to stop using the drugs so I can pass the urine stream. Because here's what the PO told me. He said, you can drink, just don't get drunk. Who does that? Why would you drink if you're not going to get drunk? That was my mentality. Because remember, one of the things we're talking about today is powerlessness. All right, if I take a drink today, then I'm going to be using heroin within either a few hours, a few days, a few weeks, a few months. Right? I cannot successfully drink alcohol. It does not work for me. So when he told me that, I was like, okay, I'll see what I can do with that. But it doesn't work for me. So I went to rehab. I was there for 4 hours. And at that time, we had a director named Kat. And she was a very direct person. She was the first person that ever told me the truth about myself. I went to her and I said, look, these people, talking about the other clients, these people are crazy. Like, they need to be here. I understand why they're here. They have a drug problem. I get it. But I don't need to be here. I remember 2 days prior to that, I had a gun to my head on a crack bench. But they're the crazy ones. And so I made the mistake of bringing my kids into it. And I told her, I said, my kids need me. And this is the first time anybody told me the truth about my addiction. She said, what have you done for your kids up to this point that makes you think it matters if you're there or not? I was like, wow. What do you say to that? And so I put my head down. I went back to my room, and I stayed there for the next 28 days. During that time, about 2 weeks in, I had my first spiritual experience that I'd ever had in my life that I could recall. And what had happened was I was going to bed, and I stayed up all night praying. And I didn't know who I was praying to. I didn't know what I was praying about, but I just started praying. And I was praying for everything. I was praying for the other clients. I was praying for uncles I haven't seen in years. I was praying for myself. I was praying for my kids. I mean, I'm telling you, I was up praying for literally 6 to 7 hours. And when it was time to get up at like 5 or 6 in the morning, I felt like I'd slept better than I slept my entire life. And when I got up, the saying, the sky was bluer and the birds were chirping and the grass was greener. And that's what I felt. And I can tell you that from that day on, nothing has been the same. That was in 2004, August of 2004. And nothing's been the same since that day. And again, I like to say that's where my story ends, and I've been living happily ever after since. But it's not. Because addiction is one of those things that you don't just go to rehab and you're fixed. I know people that went to rehab sometimes 12, 13, 14 times. right? There is no quick fix for this thing. So I stayed clean for 21 months, and I relapsed. When I relapsed, I'd put the drugs down, but I'd picked up other habits, not drug-related, mainly based around relationships. And when I started engaging in these relationships, I started living dishonestly. I was not doing things that are very conducive to a recovery lifestyle. So at 21 months, I relapsed. I stayed out using for 3 weeks, smoking pot, came back into the self-help groups that I attend, and started all over again. Stayed clean for 9 months, did the exact same thing again, went back out and relapsed again. Stayed clean for 2 to 3 years, went back out and relapsed again. This time it was a little bit different situation because when I got clean, my body started falling apart. All right, I started getting abscessed teeth. I got kidney stones all the time. And I may have had these things when I was using, but I was so high, I couldn't feel anything. And so I went to the dentist with the abscessed tooth, and he gave me a prescription for Vicodin, which is a pain med. And when he gave me that, I called one of my mentors, and I was like, look, they gave me these pain meds. I need you to help me with these because I can't manage this on my own. And he did. A couple months later, the same thing happened, except this time I didn't tell anyone. And he gave me a prescription for Vicodin again. I took the whole bottle within 2 days. I called the dentist back. I said, these Vicodins aren't working for me. Can you give me something else? So he gave me Percocet. Yeah, that's what we do, right? That's what we as addicts do. And so I took the whole bottle of Percocets within probably a couple of days as well. My justification was, is I'm not crushing them up and snorting them. I'm just eating them, so it's not really using, right? That's not what normal people do, just so you know. So I took, I took all these Percocets, and then I was able to stop. I just stopped using, and I kept going to my self-help groups, and I kept, celebrating years clean, and but in the back of my mind, I knew I was a fraud. I knew I was lying. I knew I wasn't being honest because I had, in fact, relapsed. And so 2012 comes along. 2012, I'm working at the same treatment center that I went to. I don't know how much time I have. Plenty of time? Okay, gotcha. So 2012, I'm working at at the same rehab that I went to. I'm going to college full time. I'm getting a divorce from my son's mother, and I entered into a new relationship. And I had all these good things going, some not so good, but a lot of good things going. And then something in my mind says, you know what? You deserve something. You deserve something for this. Because most of the normal people that I know, and I say normal when I say that, I mean people who aren't addicted, they go out and have a drink every once in a while. Right? They have a glass of wine or champagne or they drink a beer. And I was like, I want to do that. But here's the problem. I don't like drinking. But I do like smoking weed. Right? So I went to Floyd and I bought an ounce of the best pot that I could find. And my intention was, I'm only going to smoke on Fridays after work. Right? Now, all this time, I'm teaching a relapse prevention group at New Life, the rehab. And then I'd go home on Friday and I would get high. So I smoked on that first Friday. And it felt, there was a whole lot of feelings that came with that. The euphoria was great, but the feelings of guilt and shame were horrible. All right, so I smoked on Friday, and then Saturday came. I was like, I want to feel that again. So I smoked on Saturday. So I started smoking pot every day. My girlfriend at the time was not very pleased with this choice, and she gave me the option to flush it down the toilet, or we may not survive this relationship. So I flushed an ounce of pot down the toilet. There's probably a whole lot of happy sewer rats in Pulaski County because it was some good stuff. But then I went behind her back and I bought another ounce. And I didn't tell her about it, and she eventually found out. And once again, I had to flush more down the toilet. At that time, there was some stuff going around called synthetic marijuana or spice. They'd sell it at the gas stations. It was basically a bunch of chemicals sprayed onto a plant, and you smoked it. So I started smoking that. It wasn't detectable on a drug test yet. It didn't really have a distinct smell. So I thought I could get away with it. And when I started smoking that, I experienced paranoia and delusions like I'd never experienced before in my life. To the point where I was seeing things. I was having conversations with the devil. I was supposed to get married that July. I put that off because I was paranoid that she really didn't want to marry me. And so on June the 12th, 2012, she gave me an ultimatum. She sent me a text message and said, "Are you smoking spice?" I said, "Yeah, I am. Is that going to be a problem for us?" She didn't respond. She came home. She said, "You got two options. Either you go get help or you take your son and you get out." And so I wasn't ready to get clean yet. And so I took my son and I left. And we were homeless for quite some time, about a month. And so I would stay at hotels. I was still working at New Life. I still had my job, which is unbelievable. I don't know how that worked. But I still had my job, and I was getting money from that. So I'd stay at hotels. The nights I couldn't afford hotels, I would sleep in my car. I can say that my son never slept in my car. But July the 6th, 2012, I was driving down the road, and I've been suicidal since I was 8 years old. Right, I just want to put that out there. I can remember looking in the mirror at 8 years old, thinking to myself, "I hate you. I wish you would die." That's 8 years old. So if you've ever known any kids that are 8 years old, imagine them thinking that. And that's what I was thinking. Like, I genuinely hate myself. And so on July 6, 2012, I was driving down the road, and I had a 9mm pistol under my seat. And my thought process was, I'm going to kill my son, and I'm going to kill myself. Because I promised myself he would never see me high. And I also promised that he would have a better life than I would. And I couldn't give that to him. So I thought it'd be better if we both just died. And so once again, thank God, I had this moment of clarity that said, "You need to get your son away from you, like now." And so I took my son and I dropped him off somewhere. I don't remember where. And I went to the Walmart in Fairlawn parking lot. I put the gun to my head, and I prayed to God, "Please just give me the strength to do this. I'm tired of living. I'm tired of relapsing. I'm tired of people thinking I'm something I'm not." Because I had this reputation of being Mr. Recovery, right? I had this reputation of having my life together, and I did not at all. And so I prayed to God, "Please give me the strength to kill myself." Fortunately, that was not the plan. My phone rang right as I was saying this prayer, and it was New Life wondering why I wasn't at work. I couldn't tell you what day it was. Like, I have no idea. Like, I didn't know if it was Monday or Sunday or Tuesday. I had no idea. And so I went to work, and this counselor that was there named Mark pulled me into his office, and he said, "Chris, I need to know you're okay." I said, "Man, I'm not okay. I'm so far from okay." And so we called some treatment centers, some hospitals, and I went into a psychiatric hospital in Salem, went to Lewis Gale. I was diagnosed with drug-induced psychosis. They wanted to put me on medication to help me sleep and help me with the withdrawals, and I said, "I don't want your medicine. I want to feel every bit of this. I want to feel it when my daughter calls me and says, 'How could you do this to us again?' I want to feel it when my father calls me and says, 'What did you do with my son? Where is he?' I want to feel the physical withdrawals, the throwing up, the diarrhea, the shakes, the chills. I want to feel every minute of this." And I did. I felt it for about 2 weeks while I was there. And so I left there, it took about a year before I could look at myself again. It took about a year before I could actually pull myself out of that. And by that point, I was spiritually dead. I had no interest in a higher power, no interest in God whatsoever. And I started living on self-will, doing what I wanted to do. But I was still working at New Life. They still kept me there, still wanted to give me my job, and I couldn't do it. I could not work helping other people when I couldn't even take care of myself. So I left there and went and worked at a factory for a couple years. And so when I went to work at that factory for a couple years, I realized, you know what, I got to do something different. Something has to change, because every time my life would get good, I would self-sabotage. I would destroy it. And so I started looking at myself, and something I never dealt with was that childhood trauma that I talked about. I never dealt with the sexual abuse. I never dealt with the abandonment and attachment disorders from being adopted. I never dealt with the pain inside of having, because what I didn't tell you is my mother and father I have now, they're good people, but they're also very strict people, and they can sometimes say things that are very hurtful. And I never dealt with that. And so I started looking at all these things, and I started looking at my life, and I started looking at why. why do I keep doing this? And it all stemmed from things that happened in my childhood up to that point. I didn't know how to have relationships with people. Right? I didn't know how to live a life without using drugs. I've been doing it for half my life by the time I went to treatment in 2004. So I started working on myself, and I started looking at these things. And I started attending more self-help groups. And started going to therapy. And I started to realize that, you know, I'm not the monster that I think I am. Right? Because we deal with a whole lot of self-pity, and I deal with a whole lot of self-hatred for being who I am. And so I did that for about 2 years. I worked on myself, and I've been working on myself every day since. I haven't touched a drink or drug since July 7, 2012. And for that reason, I'm able to have the life I have today, right? I'm able to come and do things like this. You know, I have all three of my children now. My daughter's mother committed suicide back in 2006 as a result of addiction. Here's the thing about addiction that I know, that every single person I've ever met in my life in some way or another has experienced addiction. Not saying they've used drugs, not saying that they've, you know, been alcoholics, but saying they know somebody that has. And it doesn't always have to be about alcohol and drugs. It can be addiction to chocolate. Not really. It can be addiction to gambling, sex, any of those things. And so I haven't met anyone yet who hasn't experienced some form of addiction in their life. And so I went back to school and I finished my associate's degree. I got that, and I went back to work at New Life again. Actually, I went to work at the Bridge Program, which is a jail diversion program to New River Valley Community Services. Since that time, I've been working in, with addicts and addiction and recovery for the last 7 years. And to bring you up to date now where I'm at, I actually had some mental health concerns a couple years ago. I had to go to see a psychiatrist because I was very suicidal, clean. I had 5 years clean, and I was wanting to kill myself every day, or 6 years clean, wanting to kill myself every single day. So I went to a psychiatrist, got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I had no clue. I thought I just dealt with depression. I thought it was something I could manage. So I've been on medication for that, which has been very helpful. I haven't wanted to kill myself for a couple years now, which is progress for me. It's huge. More recently, the last year has been tough for me. The last year has been really tough. I'm going through my second divorce. I recently lost my job that I love. Right? And these are things that, by all rights, should have took me back out to using, because that's how I cope with this kind of pain. That's how I cope with this kind of life stuff. But what's happened is I've surrounded myself with my recovery community. Right? I've been going to more self-help groups, and I've been talking to people more on the phone, and I've been intensifying my therapy a little bit. Right? I've had to do what I've had to do, because life doesn't just stop happening because I stopped using drugs. Right? Life is still going to show up. Things are still going to happen. But one of the things about my resilience is that I know that my purpose here is not done yet. Like, I know that. There's a reason that I didn't die from all the overdoses. There's a reason that I didn't pull that trigger when I wanted to die. There's a reason that I didn't jump off the bridge in Radford as many times as I wanted to. I'm not done yet. And that to me is where my resilience comes from. Is knowing that there's still more for me left to do. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for opportunities like this, because I don't know any of you, and I've just poured my whole life out to you, right? And that's okay, because that's somebody, at least one person here is going to get something out of that, right? And that's important to me. It's important for me to break the stigma of addiction, because you've heard all the stuff, and I gave you all the edited version, trust me, all right? It's a whole lot worse than some of what I've shared. But what I can tell you is I went through all of that stuff, and I'm still here today. So if you know someone with addiction, or you know somebody that's in recovery, know that the journey is hard. It is not easy. It's something that I live with every single day. It's something that I have to manage every single day. We have what we call a daily reprieve. And I know that today, more than likely, I'm not going to get high. All right? I can't guarantee you that a year from now I'll still be clean. It's not how this thing works. It all depends on the life choices I make. But as long as I keep doing things like this, and I keep going to the self-help groups I go to, and I start going to therapy, if I keep doing those things, then chances are my life is going to continue to get better. So I appreciate your time. I appreciate you letting me come here and do this. It's been great. And that's all I have. Thanks.